We're in this series called Exiles. For some of you, you've been with us all 5 weeks so far, and so you know what an exile is. For those of you that might be new with us this morning, what is an exile? Well, an exile is essentially somebody who finds themselves far from home. They find themselves in a place that is not their home. It's someplace else. This is the story of a people who are in exile. It's a time in history we know as the Babylonian exile. And really, it's a story so far in Daniel 1 through 4 between kind of these two characters. So you have King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. Babylon is one of the largest empires in the world at that moment. King Nebuchadnezzar sits at the top. It was King Nebuchadnezzar who led the Babylonian troops into Israel. They defeated Israel. They crushed them. And then what the Babylonians would do is they would not only come in and defeat you, but they would carry away some of your best, some of the top, your nobles, your leaders, the best of the best. One of those people who was carried away into Babylon, into exile, was that guy named Daniel. So King Nebuchadnezzar, one of the things Babylon would do is they would try to take those people that they brought in, the people that they've defeated, and they would try to bring them into their empire to show them just how great and how amazing Babylon was. So one of the things Nebuchadnezzar did with Daniel, he tried to bring him into his own court. He brought him into his own court and there tried to impose on him all of the ways of Babylon. And we looked a few weeks ago at how Daniel had his convictions. He had this faith. He knew what it meant to follow God, this one true God. And Daniel, time and again, refuses to give in. He refuses to bow to anyone but this one true God. And what we find is that Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar, they almost create this, it almost feels like a friendship. Like there's almost this mutual respect for one another, to the point that Lori walked us through last week in Daniel chapter 4, King Nebuchadnezzar, the guy who defeated the Israelites. Like, if there's a bad guy in the story, it's King Nebuchadnezzar, right? This is the guy who destroyed the Israelites. He brought them away from their homeland. And in chapter 4, King Nebuchadnezzar, because of the influence Daniel had on his life, King Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 4, it's this really unique chapter in the Bible because it's a letter that King Nebuchadnezzar wrote to the entire world, all to proclaim that there is one God, and it is this God of Daniel. It's this God of the Israelites. It's the God who we're still worshiping today. And so in Daniel 4, Nebuchadnezzar sends out this letter telling the entire world there is one true God. It's this unbelievable story of transformation. It's almost like I read Daniel 1 through 4, and at the end of 4, like, I want to tie a bow on it. I want to roll the credits. Like, this is the greatest story ever, right? It almost feels like a lot of the movies I imagine many of us are watching right now, right? How many of you are, like, Hallmark Christmas movie fans? Some of you? A few of you are brave enough to raise. Lori asked us last week, if any of us would put up our tree, unapologetically, the day after Halloween every year, right? Like, my kids start counting down halfway through October, which is a little weird, but day after Halloween. Christmas movies on Hallmark, I used to watch a bunch of them. My wife still loves them. I'll be honest, I struggle a little bit because can we just name this morning, Hallmark Christmas movies have two plots, right? Like, sub in the actors, sub in the towns, there are two movies, right? The one movie, there's this Christmas tree lighting in the center of town. We do it every year, but this year we might have to cancel. And so the entire movie is trying to, can we keep the Christmas tree lighting going for another year? And at the end, sure enough, they're all gathered hand in hand singing carols around the tree as it lights up the town square, right? Movie one. Movie two. There's this lady, she runs this bed and breakfast in this quaint little village. It's this gorgeous village in the mountains. And she runs this bed and breakfast. But this year, this guy came in from the big city because he's going to build a resort, right? And we all know resort guy, like, he's the dreamy guy that comes in from the big city, like, the important but unnecessary detail, he always has abs, right? And so, like, this guy comes in, and, like, he's going to build the resort, and the bed and breakfast is going to shut down, and the owner, she refuses to just give in. And so she stays persistent, and the movie ends when Christmas morning, the resort's been canceled, and they spend Christmas morning having breakfast in the bed and breakfast, right? Doesn't this feel like this is Daniel 1 through 4, though, right? Like, there's this evil king, Nebuchadnezzar. He comes in, destroys everything, brings out all of the best of the best. And in Daniel 4, this giant transformation, Nebuchadnezzar himself is saying, there is a God, and it is this God of Daniel. I want to wrap a bow on it. I want to roll the credits. Such a great story. Except the book of Daniel isn't done. We end chapter 4 with this proclamation of this one true God. And we start Daniel chapter 5 with this. It says, King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Time out. What in the world just happened? Right? Chapter 4 ends with this giant proclamation from Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 5 starts with King Belshazzar? So, like, who is King Belshazzar, and what happened to King Nebuchadnezzar? Well, the short answer, King Nebuchadnezzar is dead. Plot twist, right? Like, who saw that coming? He's dead, and not only is he dead, but at the time chapter 5 starts, King Nebuchadnezzar has been dead for 23 years. He died in 562 BC. Chapter 5 starts at 539 BC. BC dates roll backwards. It's weird. It's how they work. But King Nebuchadnezzar has been dead for 23 years. Short answer. Long answer. I'm so glad you asked, right? Long answer gets a little bit muddy because some of our historical records that are that old get a little bit difficult. But essentially what happened is you had King Nebuchadnezzar. And remember what we talked about on, like, week one of this series, that Babylonian names would make killer names for cats. Never been more true than today. So King Nebuchadnezzar, he dies, and he's replaced by his son, Amel Marduk. Amel Marduk will rule until he's killed by his brother-in-law, a guy by the name of Nergal-Sharezer. And I get it, some of you here are like, oh, that's where Nergal-Sharezer fits into the story, right? Like, you were lost a minute ago, but now we're tracking. So Nebuchadnezzar's son gets murdered by his brother-in-law, who takes the throne. Nergal-Sharezer will rule for 4 years, until his son, Labashi Marduk, takes over. Labashi Marduk will rule for 9 months until he's killed by Nabonidus. Nabonidus will rule Babylon for 15 years, but the Babylonian people don't particularly love him. Part of the reason is because, obviously, there's all this internal drama within Babylon, right? There's this internal conflict. There's also external conflict going on. Babylon is one of the largest empires in the world. You get that way by defeating everybody else, right? And everybody else is trying to defeat you. And so Nabonidus, the majority of his time as king, is spent at war. And so he's not in Babylon. So the Babylonians don't love the fact that they have a king who isn't present with them, and they don't like that Nabonidus is not a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar himself. So they decide, we want a king who is a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar who can be here with us in Babylon. They find a guy, his name is Belshazzar, the guy we meet in Daniel 5, verse 1. So it's a little tough to figure out, but In our text, we're going to read, it'll reference Nebuchadnezzar as Belshazzar's father. The word father really kind of means descendant. Most of our historical records will argue that Belshazzar is actually most likely Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. So King Belshazzar is now in charge of Babylon. All this internal conflict, all this external conflict. And then, did you notice what Belshazzar was doing? Did you catch it? This is what Belshazzar is doing when we meet him. It says, Belshazzar was drinking his wine. He gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Nebuchadnezzar took the things from the temple. Belshazzar is using them for his party. They drank the wine. They praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Feels like the whole story just went straight backwards, doesn't it? Chapter 4 is a letter to the entire world about how there is one true God. Chapter 5, 23 years later, is this King Belshazzar throwing a giant party with his wives and concubines, both plural, right? He's doing this with the gold and the silver that Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple. It's one thing to defeat the Israelite people. It's one thing to ransack the temple and take the things out of it. It's another for Belshazzar to use those very objects that were used in the temple to worship God and now use them in this party Belshazzar is throwing and using them to worship the gods of gold and silver, of iron, of wood, of stone. It feels like the whole thing, there was all this hope, only to watch it all come crashing down. Right? There was this giant step forward, only to find it just took two steps back. And then there's all the external conflict that's going on in the story that we don't quite catch yet. But when Belshazzar is throwing the party, when he's doing this, literally destruction is at his doorstep. There's an enemy nation, the Persians. The Persians are ready to mount an attack on Babylon. It's going to happen at the end of the chapter. Chapter 5 will end, a spoiler alert, with Persia killing King Belshazzar. Belshazzar would have known it was coming. See, the city of Babylon, we talked the first week of our series, that Babylon was this giant enforced city. The walls, it had two walls around it. It had a moat. It was this city, it was thought that this city was impenetrable. You could not get in. You can't attack Babylon. The Euphrates River would run right down the heart of the city. And so what the Persians realized is the only way to get into the city is through the river, but you can't march soldiers on a river, right? So what the Persians did is they actually built a canal system to literally reroute the Euphrates so it wouldn't go down the heart of the city of Babylon so they could then march their troops on the now river, the dry riverbed. Can we name that you don't reroute the Euphrates River overnight, right? Like, this is a project that takes time. And what is Belshazzar doing? He's throwing a party using the gold and the silver from the temple to praise all these false gods. All this hope, only to watch the whole thing come crashing down. Feels very 2020 of the story, doesn't it? Doesn't it? It feels like you take a step forward, only to take a couple steps back. You have all this hope, only to feel it slip through your fingers. Nebuchadnezzar proclaims God, the one true God. Belshazzar is on the brink. The whole thing is on the brink of destruction, and they're worshiping false gods. And maybe you felt something similar, this having hope and feeling it all slip away. Maybe for you, you're a high school senior, and you saw the way the seniors last year, how their year ended. And you started this year hoping that your year wouldn't look like theirs. And now you find yourself wondering, what's yours going to look like? Right? Like, what is it going to look like? Or you're one of the people who had your senior year cut short last year, and you had the hope, you had the dream of, you get to go to college, right? The thing you've looked forward to for years. And now you find yourself largely stuck in a dorm room and this situation looks nothing like you dreamed about. Maybe for you, it's a relationship. You've had this relationship and it's been strained at times. But like every time, it feels like every time you find moments of hope, like things are going to take a step forward. It feels like you just feel it all. It all just comes crumbling back down. And you wonder, is it, why even bother anymore, right? In this story, it was King Nebuchadnezzar undoes the whole thing with this other king. And can we just name that that still feels like politics, doesn't it? Like I can think back, the first president I can remember is George H.W. Bush, right? And in a lot of ways, George H.W. Bush was president, and then he was replaced by President Clinton, who largely undid a lot of what H.W. did, right? And then President George W. Bush comes in and largely undoes a lot of what Clinton did. And then President Obama comes in and largely undoes a lot of what W did. And then President Trump comes in and largely undoes a lot of what Obama did. And then President Biden like is already claiming he'll undo. Can't it just feel like it's just this giant cycle? And we just step back and go, why even bother? What's the point? Right? My question, Daniel, in this spot. Daniel in chapter 4 sees Nebuchadnezzar proclaim God is the one true God. And then in chapter 5, 23 years later, he's been watching the whole thing crumble. What does he do? How does Daniel respond? Let's continue the story. So suddenly, and this is where the story gets really interesting. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand. Now pay attention to details. It does not say a human hand. It's like these floating fingers of a human hand, right? Like, I don't know what's more terrifying, a hand showing up or just a bunch of fingers. But suddenly the fingers of a hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace, just in case you were curious as to where. And then maybe the most unnecessary sentence ever. The king watched the hand as it wrote. What else are you going to do if a giant hand appears and starts writing on a wall, right? Like, who brought the wine, right? Like, no, you're going to watch the hand. So he watches the fingers write. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his legs became weak and his knees were knocking. Now, the translation knees were knocking is like a really nice PG way of saying what would probably happen to most of us if a giant hand showed up and started writing on the wall. Right? They got to clean up some things later. Blame Daniel. It's his fault. He put it in there. So the king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. Then he said to these wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. May the king live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed and don't look so pale, which is never the thing you want the queen to say to you, right? There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the writing means. Daniel chapter 4. In a lot of ways, feels just like Daniel chapter 2. Daniel chapter 2, you had King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, and he brought in all of his experts to interpret this dream for him, and none of them could. Until they find this one guy, Daniel, who's able to do it. Chapter 5, 23 years later from Daniel 2. 23 plus years later, we have the same story. King Belshazzar now has this dream. He's now trying to find somebody to interpret it. They bring in all of the best people. They don't help. And then it takes the queen to say, oh, hey, there's this guy by the name of Daniel, which means King Belshazzar doesn't even know who he is. doesn't even, if you're Daniel, you've spent the last 23 years watching everything crumble. The guy in charge now, the king, doesn't even know your name. The story continues. Verse 13, it says, so Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. So Daniel finds himself right back in the place, right back in the spot he was in 23 plus years ago with King Nebuchadnezzar. So my question for Daniel in this moment is, what's going on inside Daniel? What are the things he's thinking? What are the possibilities that lay before Daniel? Because I have to imagine, if I'm Daniel, I have to imagine it could be really easy to look back on everything that happened over these last 23 years. The nation had literally turned to declare Yahweh, this God of the Israelites, their one true God. And now everything has fallen apart. I have to think for Daniel, to some extent, it wouldn't be hard to just look around and just go, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Everything that happened, and we're right back where we started. Why even bother doing it again? I have to imagine for Daniel, it'd be really easy to fall into this feeling like it was all hopeless, something I want to call despair, right? Where he'd seen what was, all the hope of what was, and then he'd seen it all come crumbling down. And Daniel, it'd be really easy for him to end up in a spot where he's in a space of despair, where it all just feels hopeless. Why even bother? We saw what happened last time, and now look at where we are. I think he could have fallen into despair. I think he also could have looked to the future and looked at King Belshazzar and went, really? Like it's going to make a difference. The Persians have literally just drained the river. They are on the doorstep. I could do this, but what difference is it going to make? Right? Is anything actually going to change? I want to call that a cynicism, which is this skepticism that anything could ever be different. That I think for Daniel, it'd be really easy to look back on everything that had fallen apart, to be in a space of despair. It's all hopeless. What does it matter? Or to be in that place of cynicism, looking forward and saying, oh, you're going to change. Then the Persians are just going to crush us, right? I've got to think it'd be really easy for Daniel to go to one of two places. And the thing about either despair or cynicism is too often I think they remove us from ownership of what we might be responsible, what we might be able to do in this moment. Because despair looks at the past and laments what is. And cynicism is kind of this looking into the future saying, oh, nothing could actually change. And what happens is it could remove us from the present moment of what we might be called to do, about what the best move might be, the best decision, the best thing to do right now where he's at. So what does Daniel do? We read what Daniel does. It says, then Daniel answered the king, you may keep your gifts for yourself and give the rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. What we find if we follow the story, Daniel doesn't fall into despair. He doesn't fall into cynicism. But instead, Daniel does what he can to be good news to the people he's around in the place where he's at. It actually makes me wonder if Daniel doesn't have some words in his mind from one of the prophets. See, as the Israelites were being brought into exile in Babylon, there was a prophet whom God was speaking to the Israelites through. It's a pretty well-known prophet, a guy by the name of Jeremiah. And it was while the Israelites were being brought into Babylon that God spoke to the people through Jeremiah. And one of the things he said is this. In Jeremiah 29:7, He said, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. This is not Jerusalem. This is not their hometown. This is Babylon. Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. Seek the good of the city where you are going. It's not the city you want to be in. It's not the city you hope one day to return to. It's the city you are in now. Seek the good of it. Pray for it. Give yourself to try to help it prosper. And if it prospers, Jeremiah says, you too will prosper. But what we find in Daniel is time and time and time again. I wonder if he has those words of Jeremiah in his mind, because I see him live this all the time, where he doesn't fall into despair. He doesn't fall into cynicism. But instead, what I see Daniel do time and again is seek the good of the city where he's in, of praying for the place he's in and working for the good of exactly where he is. I see Daniel do this all the time. See, it makes me wonder for us, as we move forward, in a world where it feels like we have moments of hope just come slipping through our fingers, how do we live that example of Daniel? How do we be people who seek the good of our places? How do we push against the despair of what was and the cynicism of what might be, to free ourselves to actually live in this moment, to seek the good, to follow Jesus in this moment as people who are doing what he did, of being good news to whoever he finds himself around, wherever he finds himself. And so what I want to do is, I think for us, it's really easy for us as well to fall into those modes of cynicism or of despair. And so I want to do an exercise together. It's an exercise that helps us address kind of some of the things from our past, some of the things that were, that we carry along with us, and a way of looking forward at what might be instead of falling into the cynicism of what could be. So I want to walk us through an exercise. It's an exercise that some people will call imaginative prayer, because we're going to use our imaginations and ask God to speak to us through them. So we're going to look back, and then I'm going to invite us to look forward. So I would ask that if you would, find a comfortable space. If you want to close your eyes, if that's helpful, you may go ahead and close your eyes. But in your head, I ask that you at least fire up the engine of your imagination. Like, for kids, it's really easy. For us as adults, it gets a little more difficult because we've told ourselves we don't do that anymore. But I want to invite you to give yourself permission to fire up your imagination as we first look back on your past, on some of the things that we carry along with us that affect the way we live here and now, and then to look forward. So if you want to close your eyes, I'll invite you to close your eyes. If you want to just get comfortable and just fire up your imagination, I want you to look back, to think back into your past, to think back to something that you carry with you, some words that may have been spoken to you, something that maybe happened, something that you carry that whether you want it to or not, tells you something about who you are, your identity, your sense of worth, who you are. Maybe for some of us, they were hurtful, harmful words spoken to us. Maybe even from somebody we trusted. Maybe it's something you regret, something you did, something you said, or something you didn't do and you wish you would have, or you wish you would have said but didn't. Bring yourself back to that moment. See the walls. See the people that are present. The smell that you can smell even in your memory. Now, in that moment, in your mind, I want you to look to the side and see that Jesus is present there. Because he was. What's the look on his face to you in that moment? And then Jesus speaks something to you. He says something out loud. What is he saying to you? What is he speaking over you? And as a quick aside, if Jesus is speaking anything but love and grace, I would love to chat afterwards or encourage you to read some of the stories of Jesus. What is Jesus speaking to you? May we be people who hold that as true. Instead of the things that we hold on to, that we might hold the words that Jesus speaks over us, those things may we hold as true as we look back. And then I want to invite you to turn your imagination forward, to look forward into your future. That if you think of an ideal world a year from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, what does it look like? What does your relationship with your family look like? With a spouse or child, if that's applicable, or as children to your parents, to your friends, your coworkers? How do you feel on the inside? What are you feeling? Your emotions, your internal life, what does it feel like? And then as you envision that, I want to invite you to ask the question of what might it look like for you to live that way today? Whatever you feel like, however you're treating the people around you, what might it look like for you to live that today? Because the reality is, if we do that, we might not rush that ideal future into today, but I think we could get a whole lot closer than if none of us tried. You may open your eyes. So I think the call of Daniel chapter 5 is, instead of falling into the despair of what was and let that inform what is and how we live, and instead of falling into the cynicism, imagining that the only thing forward is bad, is a call to dream and imagine a better future. And to recognize that the way of Jesus is to live into that, to be people who are doing what Daniel had always done. Living where he is, being truly present where he is. Living the way of Jesus in the way he is in relationship with whoever he's around, wherever he is. I do believe that if we live this way, we might not be able to immediately jump to that ideal future, but I think we could get a whole lot closer. So may we be a church who refuses to think that things have to be the worst they could be, but a force that brings about the good, recognizing that we have this unique place in the world of being the vehicle through which God is continuing to work in his world, and that one of the dominant ways God does it is through his church, through you, through me, through us. May we take that role seriously, and may we live that out. Would you pray with me? God, we thank you for your church. We thank you for the stories that we're able to read across time and distance and geography and history, and the way they continue to speak to us even today, even here. God, we thank you for being the God who is always present with us. That even in the worst, we know we were never alone, we will never be alone, but that you are with us and that you are good. That you are faithful, you have always been and you always will be. So God, we pray that we might be a people who can rest on that, on your promises of knowing you are good and you are faithful. And we pray that you would use us, that you would work through your church to continue the work that you are always about bringing your kingdom more and more into its reality on earth as it is in heaven, here among us even now. We pray this all in Jesus' name. Amen.